For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
So this is the Mining Matters Podcast. We're joined now by the guys from Golden Prospect Precious Metals Limited. It's Keith Watson and Robert Crayford. Interesting time to be in precious metals, isn't it, really, guys? I mean, we've got the gold price at record highs, seeming to break through new highs all the time. And the other precious metals, at least silver, is, you know, coming along behind to some degree. What are your feelings about the current state of gold and the gold price and what's happening?
Well, it's certainly topical. Clearly, you know, we've had gold continuing to break new all-time highs. There's a number of drivers behind that. You know, gold is kind of an interesting commodity versus others, in that there are so many different factors that tie into that. So, you know, I guess the way we try and look at it is we try and distill those different factors and try and focus on what the key drivers are. Ultimately, it comes down to a kind of supply-demand balance. But, you know, this heightened uncertainty that we're seeing globally, which I'd be amazed if we don't touch on in a bit more detail, is clearly driving strong demand and from a number of sources. So, yeah, we think it's a very exciting and interesting time to be looking at, well, firstly, precious metals, but especially on the producers. We're happy to kind of take that as you wish.
So uncertainty, a key word mentioned there.
I think so. If I could step in now, I think there are several aspects to that. One, I think people are unsure as to the rate outlook. And one factor that is probably going to be an outcome of policy around the world is a need to inflate our way out of over-indebtedness. We've been spending in the West, certainly, but also in China, in order to prop up growth, which is at the low end of most people's expectations. Certainly, if you look at the UK, we're struggling to grow despite that spending. And, you know, ultimately that leads into a risk over fiat currency. And one of the interesting aspects of all that is that for the first time in a while, gold has been performing very well despite rising rates and a strong dollar. And I think that just shows a degree of willingness for investors to consider some diversification in the portfolios rather than following a simple momentum strategy that certainly played into the benefit of the Mag 7, which are the dominant drivers behind the S&P. Everyone looks at the US market, but I think that is a style of investment that is also protected by having a degree of diversification in gold. And yes, we talk about gold hitting all-time highs in dollar terms, but just remember it's even higher in non-dollar currencies or non-dollar pegged currencies. And perhaps we'll see a greater degree of purchasing of physical metal, which in the very short term has driven up US prices, certainly on the COMEX exchange, and actually opened up a slight premium in the US versus, say, the Shanghai equivalent price, because people in the States are now looking to, you know, diversify their retail portfolios, which certainly at the back end of last year were 10% in Tesla alone, never mind the broader Mag 7. And, you know, that I think fundamentally is just a hugely useful point for people to remember. Anemic growth has been propped up by huge spending. And how are governments going to find their way out of this? And I think ultimately, as I said at the beginning, it's probably trying to manage inflation upwards as best they can.
So fiat currency, you mentioned there. I mean, I find among gold bugs, people have just lost faith entirely in fiat. As a store of value, it's just not even a consideration, really. If you set it against other things like crypto, certain types of ETF and physical metals, the fiat currencies really don't tend to get a look in.
That's when we talk gold, it's very easy to glibly say the value of currencies. I mean, these are government-backed IOUs, and I don't want to over emphasize, confidence in a reserve currency, but it's very instructive to note that most of the major banks, perhaps with the exception of the US, which to a degree doesn't have the same need, but they've all been net buyers of physical gold to prop up their reserves. And that is one of the stickier aspects to this gold price move. And that has certainly been one of the main drivers over and above investment flows in physical holdings for financial sectors via the ETFs in the last year. And we had a brief pause by the People's Bank of China, and they've now, at least in a small sense, returned to the physical market with some purchases from the back end of last year. And that's just a telling factor because they don't tend to sell it. What is perhaps going to be a marginal driver of the prices is the financial sector comes back in. And as we've seen with the COMEX price, that's now trying to transfer some physical metal over to back up the financial contracts. We'll see a bit more regional demand from the US, even though it is the global reserve currency. And that, that the fact that gold has moved up with 5-year rates is quite a telling factor.
We've seen an article in the FT recently about the big movement of physical gold from London to the US. Does that have any bearing on what you were just saying about COMEX?
I think that's a consequence of, regional demand flows, mainly from the financial sector in the US. So they typically go for, a COMEX future. And I think the COMEX exchange is now wanting to make sure they've got some physical backing to that, which is why we've seen some of the flows. If you look at the Swiss data, I think they're at some of the decade highs transferring some of their gold over to the US vaults. Is it something that affects us day to day? I wouldn't say overly play that. I think our broader investment stance for gold, not just in our precious metal fund, but we've got the highest weighting ever in our broader precious metal weighting ever in our broader fund, because we do feel that the outlook is a bit more tepid in terms of industrial sector growth for other commodities, industrial metals, to an extent in the short term, even energy. That is, and the valuations of the gold equities are very much more attractive than we feel is the case for the copper miners, for example. So there are a multitude of reasons, but I don't think short-term effects like that really affect our investment approach. We look for undervalued equities, typically off the radar in terms of their market cap size, which are out of the mainstream investment scope because the liquidity might not be there. And those, if they perform, can really get a tailwind behind improving liquidity, being larger market cap weightings emerging and getting into the indices, which is a self-fulfilling, story in its own right. And that tends to be our investment approach. We like to see catalysts. Because that's certainly something that just keeps a focus on that momentum in the share price. But as a sector, it's a macro-driven view at the moment.
But I mean, just to answer that question though, so yes, we've seen the last week particularly, we've seen COMEX inventories kind of, well, they've more than doubled now from kind of pre-Trump. So entirely what we're seeing is a reaction to potential tariffs. So there's a fear in the market that tariffs could impact gold, thus you'd end up having gold therefore trading at a premium versus global market if there was an import tariff on gold. And that's led to a complete surge in COMEX stocks. That's led to a withdrawals from global stocks, and we've seen, Bank of England's stockpiles reportedly trading to a discount because they can't get them out of their warehouses quick enough. And we've seen Swiss shipments also heading to the US, and it's entirely trying to front run potential tariffs. And that's entirely what we're seeing. So, it's very much a technical thing, and it's a response to potential tariffs and potential price differential that that would create. To our investment style, I mean, we're focused on the miners, as Keith said there. So, these are kind of small differences as far as the miners are concerned, certainly versus kind of more recent volatility, and doesn't impact the revenue for them, particularly in those sort of minor price differentials. But clearly, it's if we come into geopolitics, I mean, clearly it creates a more supportive backdrop to permitting, for example, for a US project or under the current administration, and that's certainly something we're monitoring. But the bigger knock-on around this is going to be more around FX and the impact there that then has on production costs. So, that's kind of one of the key drivers we look to there. And I'm sure we'll touch on it later, but we like the mining sector, particularly the precious metal mining sector, because actually the cost pressures that we've seen aren't feeding through. FX is just one of those major inputs, and that means this massive bump that we've had in the top line revenue is going to feed through to higher margins going forward. And that's, as well as liking the physical gold price and silver price, et cetera, going forward, really the thing that we have most conviction on is that the stocks are ultimately unloved. The stocks are ultimately unloved and trade at a discount, but also we're starting to see, far easier cost pressures for the miners overall, which means higher margins, higher free cash flow, more dividends, more buybacks, more M&A.
Yeah, so valuations was sort of mentioned, and you're touching on it there as well. I mean, there's a perception, perhaps it's not completely true of every company, but there's sort of perception at large that the gold equities, especially at the smaller end of the spectrum, really aren't keeping up with the movement in the gold price. And I wonder why you guys think that is. I mean, I cast my mind back to sort of previous bull runs in gold, and generally speaking, the gold equities, even the exploration companies, tended to follow the gold price. Perhaps there was a small delay in the reaction time, but I think there's a perception that that hasn't really happened to the same level that it used to this time around. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that dynamic, and if it is in fact correct.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's completely correct. I think it's completely correct. Is it unjust? Arguably not. If we look to earlier in this current cycle, or certainly kind of not so distant history in the last decade or so, what we've seen is the gold miners, when they've got a higher gold price, have then seen their costs increase in line with that, and ultimately, what should mean margin expansion and operating leverage. Operating leverage is, if we say gold's at 2,800 today, it's a bit above that, and your costs are 1,400, then you've got a 50% margin. If gold moves up 10% and your costs stay flat, you've actually got a 20% increase in your margin, effectively, which is what they call operating leverage. And miners should experience operating leverage. So when you get a higher gold price, you should get a higher return in the underlying miners than you do the gold price. Now, the reason we haven't had that previously is that their costs have then increased in line with the increase in gold price. And then, if we look at the more recent history where we had gold rally and it break, so recent rally around COVID. So gold rallied quite strongly, the gold miners rallied strongly, and then cost inflation, which wasn't purely for the gold miners, we obviously felt it globally, but that ended up leading to higher costs and ultimately compressed margins back to a level that was comparable to pre-COVID. So you had a higher revenue line on a higher gold price, but ultimately the margins were comparable. And this is something that, even for gold bulls, is something that ended up frustrating them. And there's a real question mark around gold miners themselves. Are they good businesses? They've got this kind of ability to do M&A at bad times, hedge just at the wrong time. And I think for a lot of generalists, where they have invested in precious metal miners, they've kind of moved on and left. Now, what one thing I would like to get across today is I think there's a material shift in the underlying industry as a whole. I think CEOs that are still in their jobs are far more focused on profits, margins, capital returns to investors, rather than just growth for the sake of growth. And I think that's a real clear dynamic shift. The other thing is those cost pressures that we were seeing in that post-COVID inflationary period. Actually, what we're seeing now is many of those pressures are actually starting to reverse. So I'm not going to say that we're going to have cost deflation for the producers overall, but we're certainly seeing far easier pressures. And the major inputs there, for example, would be things like labor, where we saw material shift higher in labor costs, particularly in, say, Western Australia, where the labor market was very tight. They'd delayed their via lockdowns. They'd managed to avoid the first waves of COVID, and thus, more in the sort of 21, 22 type period, they saw more disruption on the labor front. At the same time, lithium was hot, nickel was hot, and that really led to a very tight labor market. Snapshot to where we are today is that's materially reversed. We're now seeing far more stable. We're not seeing the same turnover in staff. We've had some big facilities like Nickel West, BHP's big Nickel West smelter, shutting down, releasing a few thousand employees. Ultimately, labor overall is easing, and thus costs are also easing. We've also got lower oil prices. We've got lower steel prices than we had previously. So, it's a real shift where we've had this bump higher in gold price, and the producers themselves are now actually able to capture that margin. And it was only around kind of March of last year that we really broke those kind of shackles of the cap of $2,000 oil, sorry, $2,000 gold that it couldn't kind of break free of. And we've had that real notable shift higher. And I think there's a real question mark about the sustainability of this current high free cash flow that we're seeing for the sector. And ultimately, will that get returned to investors, or will we see a repeat of some prior cycles where the gold miners haven't necessarily used those enhanced earnings and improved returns to investors? But from what we're seeing, certainly anecdotally across our names, is there's a real focus on better capital returns, and real kind of accretive deals. So it's kind of more mergers of equals rather than big premium kind of takeouts. And ultimately, we think that's what's hopefully going to drive a reset of expectations around the sector. One of the key things is going to be bringing back in generalist investors who are pretty gun shy towards the sector. Most of the gold bulls, particularly in the junior space, have, they've got their battle scars and are limited in how much people can add incremental capital. So, the resources sector in which we're very much in, from the fund management side. They're not seeing massive inflows either. So there isn't a big weight of capital from the specialists and kind of more retail focused investors. So the thing that's really going to shift that is going to be generalists coming back in. And our belief is, repeated quarters of improved earnings, free cash flow generation, and a focus on capital returns is what's going to drive that. But back to that earlier point. So, yes. The stocks are at the cheapest kind of PNAV, price to NAV type multiples we've ever seen. Free cash flow production as a percentage for the sector is probably at record levels ever seen. And ultimately, it's going to be about kind of really regaining trust of the broader sector. And it feels like we've started to see a bit of a catch-up trade of people starting to recognize that gold at 2,800 plus. May be more sustainable, and actually it might head higher rather than it be a temporary blip, because currently the sector overall certainly implies a much lower gold price than we see today on the spot price.
Yeah, I was going to come to that. I mean, is it your view that these prices are sustainable? Because whenever anything reaches an all-time high, you've got to sort of just hear that cautious bell ringing in the back of your mind, that the graph may not look like this forever. So what are your feelings about the these levels which we're now seeing? Are they is this a new plateau, and are we moving upwards and onwards?
Right, so this is the real challenge, to try and summarize entire global geopolitics, economics into one or two sentences and its impact on gold. Because back to that earlier comment, gold is impacted ultimately by everything on some level. But if we try and distill that down to what are the key drivers and what is moving it today. So firstly, central bank demand remains very strong. We've seen the third year in 2024 of central banks buying over 1,000 tons of gold. And we look at it now, we've got a Trump presidency, trade wars, tariffs. Our belief is central banks will, as a minimum, be buying the same level they did over the last 3 years, but most probably be looking to add more. And the reason for that is that gold is a form of defense. It's a security measure against actions by a more aggressive US and a more uncertain geopolitical backdrop. So that's the quick summary on that side. The other key drivers of demand are jewelry, which we know has been weaker, against higher gold price. Ultimately, if you're, Indian wedding season, you're going out to buy some jewelry, you're going to have a set amount you're going to spend just in that price move, with gold up nearly 40% since that 2000 level. Inherently, you're going to be buying, you're going to be buying sort of 40% less than you would if you go in with the same dollar amount. And we've seen that kind of feeding through. So that has kind of happened. And I think it's very much in the numbers. The other key swing factor is around financial markets and what financial players are doing. And this is actually, Keith touched on it earlier, but I think this is one area that we're quite optimistic. So firstly, you can look to ETF holdings, which had been materially increasing or steadily increasing for 4 or 5 months. And then we came into what became clear when Trump was going to win the election. And then there was a shift there around inflation expectations and that his measures would be inflationary. And that then led to a bit of a sell-off in ETF holdings, yet gold has continued to march higher, interestingly. But we think going forward, there's going to be a much greater focus around global debt levels and the sustainability of global debt. And Keith touched on it with the comments around fiat currency, and this all kind of links and ties back in together. But it's our belief that, we have increasing, steadily increasing, well, not rapidly increasing government debt globally. We know the US has been increasing its debt levels by 3 trillion per year, currently sat at over 36 trillion. But what has changed in the near term is that we've gone from a low rate environment, which people viewed into perpetuity at some points, into what is clearly a higher rate environment. And if we're looking at more inflationary measures coming out of Trump's tariff policies, then it's much harder to try and get those rate downs and get to a level that's arguably more sustainable. So what we've seen is quite a dramatic shift in the last 18 months, 2 years, or certainly in that post-COVID period where people expected high inflation to ease and rates come back down, where now we're looking at a scenario where rates are remaining, where inflation is remaining elevated, and ultimately that increases the interest burden on US debt, which we now see interest alone is north of a trillion, and we've got something like, I think, about 30% of US debt rolling over in 2025. So that's going to become an increasing burden. And just to put that in perspective, when you talk big numbers, but $1 trillion in interest, which if you did as a snapshot today, it'd be about 1.5 trillion or so. That's versus a total tax take of 4.4 trillion the US as a whole, and they're running a $3 trillion deficit. So there's some real key questions there, and that's feeding into the financial players' argument of it. So we look to ETF holdings. We expect to see people within funds increasingly look to add gold as a source of protection. We're kind of seeing quite tight markets with that surge in COMEX holdings and US gold trading to a premium. But we think increasingly, even if we don't have a kind of Liz Truss moment in the US, which Torsten Schlock of Apollo had said was a possibility, we think as a minimum, we'll see people increasingly looking to add gold as a proportion. And this brings back in the generalists into why they would want to buy into gold at attractive levels on the gold miners. And we think that's the key driver into what is already a tight market driven by central bank demand. Weak jewelry demand is already a known. And the real swing factor there is around financial markets because the delta on that is huge.
So, do you guys think that ETFs are sucking some of the oxygen away from equities, though? Because obviously, if you go back 20 or even 20 or 30 years, certainly 20 years, the ETF market just wasn't like it is now. And anybody who wants exposure to gold used to just go into gold equities and enjoy the leverage that you were talking about earlier, Robert. Now they can just get a direct exposure to the gold price through an ETF, any kind of ETF. There's so many of them. And frankly speaking, that's not looked too bad in their portfolios over the last year or two anyway. So why take the risk of some gold equity where operational failure could happen, or you could get arrested in Mali, or any of these other issues that that arise? I wonder if you think that's actually a serious threat to equities, or whether it's more of a kind of marginal issue that plays around the edges.
100%. And I mean, I'll take a step back and don't just look at the gold miners. I think this is an issue for the global economy. We've got the shift into passive flows, passive funds with ETFs has basically led capital to head towards the lowest cost, larger, most liquid companies. And it's basically left a complete hole in trying to fund those smaller companies that are ultimately coming through and getting developed through. We've got such a weight of capital towards passive now that ultimately that's left the more junior companies broadly across the economy generally kind of unfunded. Back to your point, it used to be you could buy into a junior miner knowing that another miner will come and take it out, or it can just execute, or it'll be able to continue to raise. But it's basically left them slightly adrift ultimately. There's kind of no linkage between that. You kind of got a barbell approach of the larger liquid names, and then below that the kind of financial system is ultimately kind of broken from what it used to be. And that's one of the reasons I think now you're starting to see a major growth in private private focused equity and debt, and you're seeing a big surge in growth there in institutional private focused funds and private capital, because it's able to capture some of that window in that kind of pre-listing, and companies aren't wanting to IPO or list now until you get to $1 billion plus, because there just isn't an efficient capital market to support companies around that kind of 50, $100 million or sterling kind of level. So, how do we look at it? That's kind of our kind of bread and butter. I'm a geologist, been doing this 20 years. Keith's been doing it 30 years and been focusing on the sector as well. So, we kind of see, and it's pushed us into focusing more on that kind of $300 million to kind of 1 to 2 billion type level, because that's where we end up seeing that kind of shift to more ETF inclusion and liquidity, and there's a clearer route via mergers or operational improvements to kind of get that execution. Now, that's not to say there isn't opportunities below that. There has to be a real focus on the management teams themselves that you believe can follow through, general backing and ability to kind of execute, and ultimately just leads us to really focusing on, truly exceptional discoveries rather than kind of marginal discoveries in the juniors.
So your portfolio in Golden Prospect, does that contain unlisted companies as well?
No, theoretically it can. The reality is just with increased kind of compliance requirements, audit requirements, the fact we put out daily NAV, it became very difficult and administratively difficult to do so. So as a result, we don't have any private holdings within the fund.
Right. Let's talk about a little bit about what you do have in the fund. I've got it in front of me here. Your latest 31st December 2024 investor report. By type, developers 18.6%, explorers 9.2%, producers 72.2%, which tends to sort of go towards what you were saying a moment ago. And just while I'm looking at this, I'll just mention that you've got gold 83.8%, silver 10.1%, PGM 2.6%, and base metals 3.5%, which was perhaps a reflection on your slightly negative comment about copper earlier in the conversation. So, I mean, there's also a list of companies here that we can perhaps talk about in a little bit of detail in a minute. But why don't you guys just give us a quick sort of rundown on the way you're thinking in balancing the portfolio as you have done at this juncture?
I'd like to just like and just to add some color to one of those numbers. So yeah, I think it was 72% producers you said there. So within that, we actually like developers, but we want funded developers. So if you look at our, I think about certainly five of the top six or seven are, well, arguably seven of the top seven are producers with development assets. So we see value in the developers because they're generally kind of looked over by a lot of investors who are kind of risk cautious, and as a result we think trade at a discount. And this fits into our comment earlier about not seeing the same cost inflation pressures that we're seeing. Thus, the projects we're seeing coming through now are generally more likely to come through on time, on budget, and not have major cost overruns. So we like the developers, but we're doing that under an umbrella of having producing asset and a development asset. And we think, you know, and this comes back from a Keith's earlier points of, we really like names with catalysts. So firstly, you have the security of stable production generating very strong returns in this strong price environment, but then you have a discounted development asset also within that, that is then, you know, for, I think, yeah, certainly five of the top six have new mines coming on in 2025. And we believe that that will lead to a massive jump in earnings and a re-rate, and therefore allow that kind of discounted component coming from the development asset to kind of get re-rated and thus be a driver of capital returns. So yeah, so within that, actually within that producer component, a lot of our largest names have development assets as well. So I just wanted to clarify on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, we'll talk about some of them. I mean, Greatland Gold, perhaps, let's see if that's in the top seven. One, two, three, four, five, six. Yeah. So, but I mean, Greatland Gold is perhaps the one that will be most well known to London investors, certainly the retail community. You've got a balance, I would say, especially in the context of the current Indaba conference going on. It's not really sort of weighted towards Africa. You've got a sort of more
Australian waiting.
Yeah, it's. I better not put words into your mouth. But I mean, how do you sort of the risk element, political risk? I mentioned very obliquely Resolute and Mali a few minutes ago. I don't see Resolute on this list here. Do you have a sort of policy on risk, or do you take it company by company?
I'll step in there. I'd say where. Conscious of it, but we try and just accept that there probably is risk in mining, and there can be more so depending on where that is in the world. But we also view it in the context of what is the relative valuation of that particular stock. And if you've got something where there's a binary risk that it might lose its license but is trading at 0.05 of its NAV, taking an extreme, then we might put something sized appropriately in that if we felt that, you know, there is a risk, yes, but we can take that on the chin if it comes to a worst case outcome. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be like that. It could be a producer that's throwing off a free cash flow margin of something like 30%+, but only trading at 0.3 times NAV, and we'll put some money in that again in a hopefully appropriate quantum that we can wear it should it not prove that bad. And you know, it's not that we've escaped it. We have had things that have acted as a bit of a drag on fund performance, but you know, we're not per se absolutely risk averse to it. We'll just have to view it on its case by case and size by size situation. You know, so we've got one in Burkina Faso that is something like 8% of the country's GDP. It managed through COVID. It managed through some of the unrest that we had seen with some of the religious backed. We've seen them cope with Russian influence of the government. And, you know, we might have preferred them to reinvest some of their capital outside of the country. But, you know, they're coming off the back of a big capex hump in developing a second mine. And it's still trading at a valuation that looks pretty attractive. But we've got to appropriately size that in the portfolio. And I don't really want to over egg it. It's just to say that we'll take a risk of, you know, adjusted perspective on it. And ultimately, is it safe to go into, you know, perhaps an established Western market where permitting is so much more difficult? The cost of jumping hoops is very different. And, you know, we'll view it in that context as well. But, you know, for the main, in Australia, I would, if I bring it back to that, you know, we've got a more muted outlook for the iron ore industry, which contributes to their balance of payments, which perhaps might see a broader softening of the Aussie dollar. We've got a labour market which had been very tight for longer than people expected, actually including us, but which appears to be easing. We've got a government, certainly in a state-by-state basis, as well as federal perspective, that is becoming more amenable to permitting and allowing mines to move forward. And, you know, their margins are relatively, the outlook of those margins is better than in, say, the States, where, you know, you are more captive to the dollar cost in a very tight labour pool. And, you know, Africa fits somewhere in there, or maybe South America. You know, people are sometimes put off by other regions. One of the other countries that has done particularly well has been an asset owned by Emerald Resources. You know, it was actually technically quite challenging. It's quite a fine grind, but by God, has that guy delivered mine time after time, on budget, on schedule, expanded the resource, and he's using that capital from his Cambodian asset to reinvest in some Australian assets, which is back to that funded developer profile that is actually we like a lot at the moment. They're able to sustain their own growth. And that's something that I think is a broader industry aspect. You know, if we look at, say, the World Gold Council numbers, I think their last report said that mine output grew 1%. And what we're seeing is in a higher gold price environment, again, coming back to perhaps a more favorable, disciplined approach, is that they're not just buying others, you know, any price. They're probably lowering the cutoff grade in order to try and increase ounces. But that doesn't necessarily, on the large cap miners, translate to margin expansion to the same degree that we're after. They're just sort of being able to manage more of the ore body, which might have a higher strip, but they get the ounces out at the same unit cost. And, you know, we're looking for things that can do much better than just play around with optimizing cutoff grades. We want to see them actually deliver new projects that are much higher margin. And those are the ones that you'll see in our top holdings on our fact sheets.
So you mentioned... I might add a little color on that, but I mean, just on jurisdictional risk. So yeah, we're very open to taking jurisdictional risk at the right price, which, you know, Keith was saying there, but it's so nuanced. You know, I mean, we focus on West Africa, which is probably one of the most complex, and it's really, it's kind of you could have quite an in-depth knowledge of kind of what's going on, what the moving parts are. You know, so there are countries that we like in West Africa, and we think you can ultimately get names that are overly cheap because people perceive the risk as too high by blanket being negative on West Africa. We have zero weight in Mali. That's kind of a bit done for us. We have zero interest in re-entering that, but, you know, we do like, you know, Guinea, Senegal, Ivory Coast. So we see, you know, we see some attractive opportunities in those, and we think they're cheap because of getting captured under this blanket umbrella of West Africa. But, you know, Keith touched on Burkina Faso. You know, so even within Burkina Faso, we wouldn't invest in a company or in assets north of Ouagadougou because of security issues to the northern border towards Mali. but we are comfortable south of the capital, where we know that there's higher security and therefore able to operate. But you know, it's far from zero risk, but ultimately there is a price for that. And within those higher jurisdiction, higher perceived risk jurisdictions, then yeah, we effectively just apply a shorter effective life to the assets or want a higher multiple. But actually, I think sometimes the risk of being in perceived tier one is massively underestimated, because having an asset in the US now is very difficult, because you've got a very strong US dollar, you've got tight labor markets, you've got labor issues. So that's ended up leading to cost inflation, which will feed through to the likes of Barrick and Newmont on their Nevada assets, even under an easing kind of regulatory backdrop as far as permitting, et cetera. So, you know, when people talk jurisdictional risk, they always think about an asset getting expropriated tomorrow. But we think about it's far more nuanced and far more complex than that, and kind of feeds into FX, feeds into the you know, feeds into costs, feeds into, you know, how things shift going forward. And it isn't as straightforward as just can it be expropriated or not. And actually, in many cases, what we found for these West African or African miners in general is they actually have a far more friendly backdrop politically, because it's such a large component of overall country GDP and therefore more supportive. So you know, this is similar to other perceived high jurisdictional risks. Keith touched on it with, you know, Emerald with their asset in Cambodia. They have a very supportive government that are now bringing them assets and saying, oh, can you develop this, rather than them having to go cap in hand and request. Permitting is expedited. You know, it's just a much easier place to operate. So it's far more nuanced than just straight perceived risk. I think that's something that I just wanted to add to that.
And Keith, you were talking about leadership, at least in passing, as regards the performance of Emerald. What do you guys think about leadership as regards gold mining companies or mining companies in general? I mean, the cliche has always been that, you know, good leadership can make a modest asset really good, whereas a good asset under bad leadership can go wrong very quickly. And do you sort of subscribe to that view? And if so, how do you sort of quantify it, or how do you make it work?
I could categorically say that such hackneyed phrases have truth behind them that's time told, and it shows in the performance that they certainly can make a good asset that much better, or actually just turn around one that people would have completely shunned. As I say, you know, taking on a high sulfide, fine grind, technically challenging project in Cambodia was something that resulted in that Emerald Resources being at a fraction of its valuation and market cap at outset. But I've got to say that management team has just been outstanding. They had some experience internally in other operators such as Regis, and they delivered mines for that wider Australian group in on a number of occasions. So they had that operational experience, but they translated it as a team. I think there were three of them that went over, and they've since sort of spread around a little bit and moved on from that individual team. But you know, when you look at Morgan Hart, he just has a track record of delivering, and it has turned a challenging asset, you know, as you say, one of those into an absolutely fabulous cash flow generator with growth potential. They're finding satellite pods around the existing plant site that just will extend that mine life over and above what people thought at the outset. And so ultimately, yes, we do like that. I'd say it forms a core increasingly through our tenure in this industry. It is a core tenet that we like to see a track record. It has made such a difference. Even when things have gone wrong, as they do, inevitably, they're able to just take perspective, put it in context, stabilize it, and recover from it. You know, and we look at things like Ora Banda, which would probably in that camp, an Australian asset that has now opened up two separate large operations that can now provide much more counterbalance to each other, give you operational flexibility, And, you know, they're coming through with recovering results and getting back ahead of where they'd started. And, you know, that is a good one. If you're able to back management teams like that through distress, you can do well. So it's not just a case of going from scratch. Sometimes it's how they react to difficult situations. And that is the proof of the pudding that has translated in many of the cases in those holdings that you see there. Absolutely.
Yeah, tell us a bit about Ora Banda because it's your biggest holding, as you reported at the end of December, and not all the London investment community might be familiar with Ora Banda. What's some of the sort of salient features about it as a company that you like?
Essentially, it's opened up new mining operations at very high margin that are improving, and it's growing its production base at an attractive valuation. It's as simple as that, really. I wouldn't want to push it. I don't think it's, you know, some of the underground operations have taken a little bit longer to get to, but they're higher grade now, and they're hitting their straps and stride in terms of how they are pulling ounces out. And he's got some very good operational experience. He was with Northern Star, so we like that the fact that he's been able to cope with quite a difficult background. You know, Luke will speak to fairly regularly.
Yeah, I mean that was very much to that earlier point, backing management. He was COO at Northern Star. He was taking marginal assets that were open pit, taking them underground, which triples the grade, putting through the same mill, so you basically triple the grade and output, and more than triple your free cash flow in doing so. But yeah, a truly solid operator. And the other thing is sort of skin in the game. So we really look for management teams that put in hard dollars, and we don't want to see them kind of getting free options on shares. So you know, he stepped up and put in multiple millions on himself because he had been successful. He's done this many times before within a bigger company, and this was his first foray into actually being a CEO. But he put in hard dollars and backed himself, and that was, you know, what gave us the conviction over and above knowing his ability as an operator.
Do you guys go and visit these mines yourselves?
Less so. In our time in the industry, we have seen a number. Now, actually, there are very good systems that allow us to do things to sufficient level remotely. So we'll look at the verifiers and things that can, in many cases, be adopted as tools for use by the companies themselves, and that they'll just be able to show us overheads, plan views, work in the underground wireframe models and proposals. But sometimes, you know, we also have to work within the constraints of the size of our funds and our expense ratios. And, you know, we do go to the odd conference now and again and meet them. Going out to see assets is something that I'd say, on balance, we've probably done less frequently lately in the last years since pre-COVID, actually. We've just been quite focused on managing our costs. And hopefully, it's something that we'll pick up again at a certain point in time. But, you know, we see hundreds of management teams, loads of assets. I'd say, from the gold industry perspective, it's probably one of the most fragmented mining sectors globally. You can mine from thousands of ounces to millions of ounces around the world. And so we could spend a lot of time out of the office looking at those. And in the main, you know, we're very comfortable reading the technical reports, looking at some of the latest verify information, which can show you things like vein structures underground or, you know, proposed pit shells, and taking a view off that. You don't have to go to site. It can be good. I'd say, in the main, though, from my perspective, without putting words in Rob's mouth, it's equally important to meet the management face to face, because I think there's nothing better than seeing the whites of the eyes and reading the body language. That can be such a significant factor in the process as a soft subjective issue to consider.
You mentioned that you see a lot of people. Perhaps this is not a question that you want to answer with any candidness, but I mean, do you turn down a lot of opportunities that are put across your desks?
Yes, I'd say de facto, you know, we've only got a certain number of positions in the fund. It's nice to keep a temperature of what projects and regions might be, you know, passing through London or through Canada or wherever it happens to be in Europe. In the main, they'll come through London, and we can see them in our offices or at conferences being held around the world. But yes, I think, you know, we will undoubtedly turn away an awful lot of opportunities because they don't meet the criteria of outlook, basic costs and growth, you know, management, credibility and track record, or valuation. And, you know, we'll screen things through that matrix. I don't, that sounds a bit hackneyed as well. But, you know, we do look for projects that, if they're not producing already, have a very good chance of being mines. And at the moment, you know, Rob outlined it earlier, really one of those factors which might well become more of a requirement is scale or scalability. And, you know, there are very few large-scale resources around the world of, say, 5 to 10 million ounces that would interest a major. And I think this brings us back to your earlier point, and when we were discussing valuations, if we jog back, say, even just 10 years, the valuations of the miners were very, very different to their current levels. You know, the majors were trading on, say, 2.5 times NAV. Now, admittedly, the gold price, this is on spot gold, the gold price has seen those valuations reduced to, say, a slight premium to NAV for the big liquid players. The smaller cap developers that Rob and I prefer to concentrate on, the ones that are off the radar of most of the mainstream momentum players, if I could describe them as that, are at hugely different valuations. And they were more expensive now, but they're now trading at maybe a half NAV or less at the sort of where we're looking at them. And we just want them to get up to NAV and maybe re-rate beyond that as their growth, their superior growth gives them higher valuations and repeatability. And you know, that's how it works, but we do turn down an awful lot.
Do you think NAV is a useful measurement for a developer or an explorer? I mean, you're talking about NAV in general terms there. I wonder how to apply that to.
That's a good point. And you know, NAV for a producer is typically derived from its discounted cash flows on what you think the production and cost profile and therefore profitability and cash flow will be out for the resource or reserve mine life. If it's an underground miner, which typically only has a short reserve life because it's quite costly to develop and it might only drill 2 or 3 or 4 years ahead, you know, we'll take a view on the longevity of that ore body structure. And, you know, Rob has got very good experience in terms of, you know, weighting that more so than myself, actually. He's the geologist by training. And, you know, typically they'll have flexibility depending on the number of stopes to be able to see through difficult times, blend ore to get that, what I'd call quality of earnings, where they can smooth things on a more consistent basis. Not always, but they will tend typically to trade at a premium to NAV, the underground silver miners, particularly typically of vein structured. Producers, though, that's a cash flow basis. When we're looking at exploration assets or development assets, a development asset's probably defined a resource, is putting costs around that, and you'll be able to do a discounted cash flow on it, but it will need funding and we'll need to assess the dilution that might result from that, which affects the net asset value per share. And then if it's just an explorer, we'll have to put what's a dollar per ounce value on it. And typically these things are ignored by the market, frankly. So most explorers are out there now, and no one has any interest in them in terms of their relative valuations compared to the large cap. So we see some potential in that, but we still prefer the sweet spot of those that have a project which is growing to 5, hopefully with the intention of getting to 10 million ounces. So looking at something like CNL over in South America, Colombia, you know, they just announced a nice drill hit that says they might add 6 million ounces to an already large scale resource that looks like a mirror image of Ari's prior one. So that's something that we'll look at. But it's got the prospect of being a mine.
Do you guys have a lot of investments outside of your top 10 holdings? I mean, I think the total is 53.78%, it says here. So presumably you do. And what are the nature of those other holdings?
I'm happy to go on that. We have a pretty high conviction sort of top 10, and then you drop below that and you have a bit more sort of 2s and 3s%. But then as you kind of work further down, I can't remember what the total number of holdings is now off the top of my head, but sort of circa 50 or so. But given the high concentration for the top 10, 20 there, that you can see there's obviously like a longer tail. So within that, we'll have a number of positions that might be kind of, you know, 0.5% type weighting, and that might be some of these earlier stage projects that we see, you know, kind of 10 bagger type potential, but it's a case of lack of certainty around what the catalyst and timing on that is, and sometimes there's a degree of patience required for that, but also within that there's some warrants that we've received, that you receive with placements. So particularly in Canada, a lot of the junior miners, when they do equity raises, you'll often get a half warrant with them, which are kind of sat there in the tail, which can sort of add a bit of extra juice to the portfolio in a stronger market like we're seeing today. I kind of adds a bit more diversification below that, but it ultimately we like to have quite high conviction on our larger positions. But below that, there's a sort of larger pool of names. And if, for example, Orobanda had been one of those smaller names, and actually it's been very strong performance, that has ultimately led to it having this position size. And if anything, actually, we've been sort of steadily selling that because the position sizing was getting too large. But we're kind of happy to run it as conviction view, particularly as we can see clear line of sight to de-risking on catalysts as new projects come through. But you touched on Greatland as well earlier, which is one that I think is definitely we could definitely add a bit more colour on if people have a view.
Yeah, I mean, Greatland is, I sort of make a bold statement. It's probably the most widely followed gold stock in the UK, I would imagine. I don't know if anyone can verify or deny that, but certainly it's the one that caught everyone's imagination in the past few years. And obviously it's been going through some pretty major sort of changes too in recent months. So yeah, so you've got Greatland down at number 6, I think, in your portfolio with... about a 4.29% of the portfolio. What do you want to say about Greatland?
Yeah, so I mean, we do really like it here. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. You know, Sean Day, another to come out of Northern Star, where he was CFO. Look, we've been following the company for a long time, but. Ultimately, they had their 30% working interest in the Havieron asset in Australia. Ultimately, looked quite rich on that. You know, I think it's probably widely followed in the UK, not least because there aren't many UK gold stocks really left anymore. You know, particularly when we lost Randgold, it's a fairly limited, certainly limited of on the producer side anyway. But so they had 30% working interest in Havieron, and then more recently with Newmont having bought Newcrest, who had the other 70%, Newmont were selling down non-core assets under which this came. And given Greatland had a first right of refusal on the asset, that ultimately led them in a perfect place to bid for that. So for their market cap, they managed to buy the other 70%. Given they have 30%, they bought the other 70% of Havieron, which in its own right was a great deal, but they also bought the Telfer mine and the Telfer mill. So that's a huge mill of 20 million tons per annum. The Telfer mine itself is very much viewed at the end of its life, but there's some low-hanging fruit under which they will almost certainly increase mine life at that asset. Thus, they have effectively got that effectively for free. But there's also a big extra benefit to that in that Newmont had continued to run the mine despite having a concern around a tailings dam issue that hadn't been an issue and wasn't a regulatory requirement for them to shut in. But given internal reasons, they decided to do a full review of that, make some remedy those issues. But continued mining, and as a result, have a huge stockpile of ore, gold ore, on their run of mine ROM pad, as well as some lower grade ore. And the mill hadn't been running because they hadn't been feeding that into their tailings dam. So this is something we think is kind of underappreciated by the market. And effectively, despite already arguing that what was a very cheap purchase price for the remaining balance of the asset, they effectively get a payback, particularly in this gold price environment, of about 15 months, just on the ore that's on the ROM pad, and then effectively get everything else for free. They've got clear line of sight through drilling that had already been conducted to mine life at the Telfer mine, and this will allow them to self-fund expansion or bring through Javier on mine, which will then fill through at a later date at a notably higher grade. Financially secure, they've got credit lines in place, which, given strong gold price environment, they probably wouldn't need. So, it's one that we think is certainly interesting. And there's also a big technical factor in, we know UK mining stocks, UK in general, is kind of depressed valuations versus global. Greatland will look to do a dual listing in Australia, probably shift their primary listing over to Australia. I think they're aiming around mid 25, so 2Q may slip into 3Q depending on the regulator, but that would likely be a catalyst towards a re-rate because it trades at a notable discount relative to its Australian peers for an Australian asset that's in production with strong free cash flow. So yeah, it's one that we think certainly interesting and one of the reasons we own it with a strong management team and strong backing.
Did you get in early with Greatland, you guys?
Not early. No, we having followed it for years, having had many meetings with them, we were looking for the key catalyst, which was consolidation of those assets. So yeah, we got in on the equity raise that they did in closing the deal.
Right. I mean, I guess it's I mean, the two points that occur to me about Greatland are one reason why it's so widely followed is it's one of the few companies that really delivered on the dream over the past 15 years. It was a kind of penny stock, and then it went to, I mean, I can't really remember, but I think it was upwards of 850 million market cap, maybe even more. So there's that aspect of it. It was like one of the few really good success stories. But I suppose the other thing, a bit more recent, is that, one reason why this transaction occurred was because of the corporate activity higher up the chain. It wasn't really because the assets were in trouble or unwanted. It was much more to do with kind of reshuffling that took place at the Newcrest Newmont level. So that's partly why I imagine the good valuations on that deal that you're talking about were available.
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's quite a technical factor. And we really love these kind of technical factors that drive valuation re-rates because it's just the nature of where the market is. But I mean, there's a much wider regional play there. We also have exposure to one of their neighbors, which has a couple of million ounces in a company called Antipa, which will likely ultimately get folded in as well to fight to supply into that mill. And we've seen that, performing very well. It's a 400% or so in the last couple of months on the back of following on from this deal and expectations around that, because a lot of the Australians are restricted on being able to invest in UK stocks, thus are trying to play it through the Australian proxies, which in this case is Antipa. So yeah, it's one that's interesting. Hopefully they deliver. It is mining. It's never risk-free, but there's a clear valuation. Positive valuation potential re-rate, particularly on that Australian listing versus versus comparable peers.
You mentioned in your December investor report that you see 2025 as likely to include quite a lot of M&A activity as a sort of general point. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, we're sort of a month and a week in Darbus happening. There may be some deals being concocted down there, and then and then we've got PDAC coming up as well. How do you think the M&A scene is going to look for the rest of the year?
If I just quickly mention, I would put all of this against the backdrop that it seems like the reserves of the existing large miners, they're depleting, and that they are, I think, minded to reduce their cutoff grades. That's a backdrop which encourages them to look for higher grade reserve replacement, particularly relevant given the valuation differentials of them on most metrics versus, say, something that is meaningful further, a smaller operator. So we don't per se invest on the prospect of an asset being taken out. Maybe Havieron and Greatland is a slightly different take on that, in that Rob had been watching it for a couple of years prior to this deal, knowing that ultimately it was going to be pregnant with a consolidation raise to bring it back on stream, or develop it to feasibility study actually midway through this year for the real underground event. But I think it is cheaper to buy than build at the moment. And it's quite interesting that Barrick, for example, and going back to your earlier point on jurisdictional risk, is now looking at, Reko Diq and looking at something of that nature. Is ballsy by Mr. Bristow, but he's got track record in his favour versus others, so good luck to them. But I think equally, others might just actually prefer to bolt on something that is scalable. Again, back to our point, we want things that have a reserve or resource that can be grown and material enough to make a difference. And it might be that the initial stages of consolidation are, mergers of equals, if you want, for in terms of smaller caps scaling together. You can cut out a bit of G&A from duplication of management and get some other synergies that drop out from that. Maybe it's just as simple as more diversification, which can give you flexibility that is valued more highly than a single asset. We'll see. But I would say the environment now is much more favorable in terms of the relative value gap between large and small gap. But crucially, I may have lost the thread earlier, but the valuations more generally for the whole sector are at a more acceptable level for investors, I think, than 2.5, 3 times NAV is quite punchy. And you can issue paper for paper consolidation, as happened in, 10 years ago. And I think there's something that's weighed on corporate pers or the perspective of investors on corporate managers. Now, I think maybe they've worked through that and are perhaps more empowered to go and consolidate the industry from a better valuation basis.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen our share of bad deals in this industry as well over the years, as well as good ones. So, I mean, it's not always an easy win to conduct a corporate transaction.
It's not, but I think it's a different game when you're the basis of corporate decision making isn't from, confetti at trading at 3 times NAV, where you're buying someone at 2 times NAV. Both are arguably expensive on that basis. If you've got something that's a slight premium to NAV, buying something at a discount to NAV, that is a fundamentally better basis for transaction.
Yeah. So talking of NAV, before I forget, your own NAV, so far as I can tell, trades reasonably or is currently trading reasonably in line with the share price of Golden Prospect. Now that's sort of quite looks quite good to me, in the sense that often see big discounts for investment companies to NAV. What do you think are the drivers in the way your share price trades in relation to the NAV that you guys put out?
I might start. I mean, I'd say our discount is frustratingly wide, actually. I mean, it's kind of been tracking around the sort of 20% discount more recently. And, you know, that's because NAV has been lifting and the share price kind of feels like it's lagging. But yes, I mean, it hasn't widened. We find it kind of frustrating where that's sat, especially given kind of the strong returns we've seen, both absolute and relative on the trust overall. You know, we are aware on Golden Prospect that the volatility, you know, is reasonably high given the nature of where it is in the sector and where it's exposed, and maybe that's a factor. But you know, it's something we would certainly like to see come tighter. And given the strong environment we believe we're in, and we're certainly seeing with all-time highs, is we'd anticipate that to hopefully close. But you know, ultimately we're not. It's difficult in what, yeah, we're limited in what we can do from our side in kind of addressing that, other than kind of going out marketing, telling the story, and yeah, trying to address from that front.
But I think this also comes back to the discussion point of earlier, in that equities have lagged the physical gold market. And I think, as much as anything, you know, that the current issues that the UK investment trust market is experiencing might well be reflective of this, is there's just so much passive money being invested at the moment, rather than looking at, say, gold equities. It's just going into a physical ETF or a, you know, to an extent, something which is perhaps not as, you know, even the gold equity ETFs are benefiting a bit better than, say, the closed-end market. But I think, you know, so style is one factor that does affect, you know, that the valuations of that we feel are a bit too wide or discounted at the moment. And, you know, there's a good chance that something prompts change in that regard. You know, if we get a hiccup somewhere along the line because there's geopolitical events, or, you know, we get a currency peg cracks, then things can very, very quickly change. You know, another wind might just come along and really ignite the sector. But, you know, it's a shame, because it is frustrating for us that we are floating around a 20% discount. We feel that really investors should be looking at, we would say this, but we think they should be looking to diversify their portfolios. And I think when you roll forward, what are your opportunities to invest? Maybe do have some physical in there, but don't forget that you might, in just doing that alone, be missing out on some allocating a smaller amount of capital into equities which have, for whose valuations have way lagged the gold price move, who are operationally leveraged into this, and, you know, where there might be a tailwind developing for M&A to correct some of the valuation mismatches more quickly than otherwise. So, you know, I think that's the main point of this discussion that we're having. I think investors should start thinking for themselves, actually, should I squirrel a bit of defensive insurance away in my portfolio? Because I find it absolutely ridiculous when we hear, anecdotally as it is, that 10% of your average US retail investor's portfolio is in Tesla. And it, you know, that might be more than half of the portfolios, or some such as in the broader Mag 7. That just strikes me as complacency in a market which probably demands anything but that.
Yeah, although they'll be doing better than if they'd had it in certain of the mining equities right as we speak. So,
Well, you're absolutely right, but, you know, you have to start thinking differently at some point. And yes, I t fully take on board your comment. Timing is as much a factor as value.
yeah. So what's going to happen next then? I mean, we've got a sort of tumultuous time ahead of us, I suppose, and gold looks attractive in that sense. I remember Algy Clough once said to me, "You really don't want the gold price to go too high because it means the world's on fire." And it seems like we're sort of getting to that point. And I sort of feel that gold is the ultimate hedge, always will be the ultimate hedge, even more than crypto. That's a personal opinion, but is there a point in which you think gold goes too high?
Possibly, but I think you have to look at this in a wider context, in that, what do the balance sheets of countries look like at the moment? And in the main, I find it ironic that we've gone through tranches of quantitative easing, which means that, the authorities own most of the stuff they're issuing in a process of money printing. And we've barely lifted off tightening from the recent COVID-related QE. And we're already hitting the buffers in terms of economic growth that's so desperately needed to try and pay off that debt. And so where does it go? I just think that if you view the quantum of gold in central bank reserves, which ultimately are propping up countries and currencies, it's still a fraction of probably a sensible number. And in the meantime, we've got a de-dollarization because the world seems to be splitting into, one side or other. Basically, Sino-US is the big faction. Arguably, you want to be in a country that's agnostic. India's done very well. It's, in part, yes, it's a bit more sluggish because its bureaucracy holds it back. But wow, as an entrepot for wheeling out discounted Russian crude, semi-processing it, and topping up their GDP, which hit double digits at one point last year. Maybe we just need to, think like that. And in the meantime, I just think, would I rather own something that's going to take my children's life to earn back earnings from, which might not have the energy to support it, or would I just put a little bit of money into something which will give me flexibility if things go wrong? As you say, you've got to be careful for the world you wish for, but it's very unpredictable at the moment, and it's telling that in our broader fund that can invest outside of gold, our biggest allocation is gold for the moment.
That's right. So you, I mean, you guys are part of CQS, and we haven't really mentioned CQS at all. But I mean, I didn't know that about CQS in terms of allocation. Are you talking about CQS or NCIM?
No, I'm talking our fund. So we run, Rob and I run three closed-end trusts, one of which is a dedicated precious metal fund. We have another one which is involved in the nuclear industry, and then we have a broader resources fund, the Growth and Income Fund, which pays a dividend, and that can invest in this full suite of resources globally, anywhere in the capital structure. But we've got mainly equities and mainly gold equities as the largest sector allocation of over 40% of assets in that fund, because we just feel that that's where the better value is on a relative basis in the current environment. And the outlook is sluggish in terms of growth. That sluggish growth is requiring, as we've said before, more subsidy and spending, which isn't really being raised by the outcome of that growth. And as a result, debt is a serious issue. Fiat is
Just
one of the biggest contributors to inflation.
to add the names there to clear that up. So that's CQS Natural Resources, Keith was talking about. And then we have Geiger Counter, which is the uranium focused fund, and then obviously Golden Prospects that we're talking about today.
Yeah.
And the relevance of that, if I just interrupt, is that we have a wide perspective on global growth, global commodities, and one of the other bigger factors is that is energy policy and government policy more broadly. Is it great to have tariffs in such an environment? I think most history books would say they're not necessarily the best mechanism to try and encourage growth.
Well, it seems like he's just using it as a kind of foreign policy tool at the moment, though, doesn't it? Rather than an economic policy. So I sort of remain a bit agnostic about whether Trump is actually going to use tariffs economically. He just seems to want to use them to push people around, which, on the face of it, has worked on the evidence of about 10 days. What then happens next? I mean, you mentioned the tariff, the idea that the markets have that there might be a tariff on gold at the top of the conversation. And I haven't heard any US government people talk about that myself. So I don't know if that's a really if that actually is realistic. I mean, do you guys think that will happen, a tariff on gold?
I would be dubious on that, to be honest. I don't think that's very likely. What I would say, just for the early comment, is that actually, if you look, well, our view, and it's all views at this point because there's no certainty, but we do think he's going to look to tariffs as a major source of revenue generation for the US. And he said that he's looked at some prior periods where the US used to have more tariffs and no income tax. But I think he would look to more tariffs to reduce income tax and corporate tax. Certainly that's what he stated, and we think it's something he'd likely follow on with. Gold specifically, I think he would be very cautious on doing so because he would have some wider disruptions to financial markets, etc. But and with Trump, never say never. It's all possible. I mean, I think just, there's certainly some things going on with the US market currently and technical drivers of those flows into the COMEX. And it could be around option structures, it could be around other aspects. So it might be far more nuanced than a straight single trade. But it is clear there are some material flows going on and that are being driven by that. And arguably you're seeing some degree across other commodities as well.
Yeah. So before we go, because we've been talking for quite a while now, perhaps we could just have an honourable mention for silver. You've got we mentioned it earlier, 10 just over 10% of your portfolio is silver, and in the companies like MAG Silver is quite a prominent holding that you have. Is there anything in particular about silver that that differentiates it from gold that you would sort of highlight in the way you structure your portfolio or in the way you sort of view the coming year and your investment strategy?
Yeah.
You go, Rob.
So split emotions around silver, and I'll kind of explain why. Firstly, we do like silver. Key reason being that it's over 50% industrial demand now, which is a notable shift from where it was. It had to weather the whole change from photography, where you lost its use in developing pictures, and then we've now shifted to electronics being the primary driver, and that's a real kind of inflection point. So that inherently makes us kind of bullish for silver demand because the key drivers are high-end electronics, and we look to things like EVs, wind turbines, solar, as key drivers. And then undoubtedly, given it's the only metal that's a better conductor than copper, undoubtedly feeding through into kind of AI data centers and chip infrastructure, although we don't have hard data of the breakdown on that as yet, but undoubtedly, very high-end electronics, you'd like to see some benefits around switching, etc., going forward. So that creates quite a bullish backdrop. Near term, there's a degree of caution given the shift back from net zero focus from the US under Trump. So, scaling back a lot of the renewable spend there on solar and wind in the US. So that's going to be a temporary blip. The other pushback we have on our silver exposure, which is why we're not larger, is we inherently struggle with paying a premium multiple for a silver miner that is often in a worse jurisdiction than a gold miner. So we get that there is this kind of inherent leverage that you kind of get in silver's move versus gold, and we like the industrial driving backdrop and the growth story to that, although appreciate some risks. We just kind of struggle with why a miner in Mexico should be at 1.5 times NAV when we can buy a gold producer for 0.6 NAV in Australia. So it's kind of is that kind of whole offset, and that'd be why we aren't a larger weighting other than like in the underlying commodity. So you just kind of explain to it, it's a bit more nuanced. I'd say we probably have a bit more conviction around central bank demand for gold than we do kind of electrical build out or electrical demand given a kind of squeezed consumer globally. But ultimately, we are quite bullish on EV rollout, despite what we're seeing in Europe, given, a real slowdown in EV sales. Really, if you look to what BYD is doing in China and rapid expansion there, and ultimately they've probably got getting towards a a peak proportion of overall kind of Chinese sales near term, or at least the rate of growth is going to slow. But Xi, and certainly within Chinese policy, and when they're short of growth, is increasingly going to try and look to export EVs as a major pillar of kind of Chinese industrial growth going forward globally. So that in itself would also be a driver of silver going forward, and we think we've probably got somewhere close to kind of peak thrifting in much of its application. That said, under a higher price environment, there is a kind of thrifting aspect to that that could ultimately slightly lessen on the demand side. So nuanced, and probably name specific, I guess, would be kind of trying to explain our positioning in that. But Mexico is looking better. It's definitely taken a shift for the better, having been in quite a sort of dire negative place for kind of permitting and mining rights for the last couple of years.
And Mexico being the location of the world's largest primary silver.
So we quite like names that have silver as a major kicker, within a kind of polymetallic type production, or have some offset and the optionality that provides. And if you can find something out of Mexico, that's been good, although Mexico has notably shifted better in the last few weeks, at least anyway.
And one thing that we're watching for, I mean, subjectively, the gold silver ratio is at the more attractive end of its historic range, which just gives us a view on do we even want to look at it? But 80% of mined silver comes as a byproduct, and what we would like to see now is some curtailment of industrial mine production, which brings some silver units along with it, reduced so that the byproduct output falls. And we're not quite seeing that yet. The copper price is still up there for the type of macro environment that we've seen. The polymetallic metal prices, similarly, the lead zincs that actually are more associated with silver, don't seem to have curtailed to the extent that might be expected. And just for the time being, I think the market, having been in deficit, is moving more into balance because there's been a pickup in recycling supply. So we're watching it. And we might go back to what's been, higher than 20% levels, but we don't just necessarily see that right now. Mag Silver, we mentioned earlier, is one that we don't mind. If Fresnillo can get to terms with its asset, it's certainly a consolidation opportunity for Fresnillo that effectively is the operator of that 60-40 JV that Mag has an interest in. So it's a market we do like, but it's timing.
Fair enough. All right. Well, should we draw it to a close? Golden Prospect, kind of sort of venerable name in the junior mining investment world, I would say. I mean, I remember when it started out all those years ago, and you guys have, kept it afloat, and here we are all these years later with the shining light of high gold prices, high silver prices ahead of us. So, I wish you guys all the best for 2025. And perhaps if you've got any other remarks you want to say before we close it out, I'd be happy to throw the floor open for some sort of concluding thoughts, if you have any.
I mean,
Insurance.
is it? I think we've covered off most things, but yeah, I mean, I think it's really that kind of focus on valuations, which we don't think current spot prices in implicitly reflecting, and therefore makes it an attractive sector to look at and overlooked by generalists.
Yeah, so you, I mean, I guess to sort of on that point, you mentioned that you see a lot of people, so you're going to be on the lookout for attractive valuations and hopefully bringing some of those opportunities into the portfolio in the coming year.
Yep, certainly, and it's also kind of as one of our CEOs puts it, is you've also got to try and mine the market as well as mine the asset, and it's kind of how do you create value through sensible deals, and we've seen across a lot of our names where mergers of two companies, it's a 1 + 1 = 2.5, if not three, kind of benefits, and that's something that they're clearly focusing on given the kind of languishing state of the sort of junior mining sector. Is having to look to more accretive deals to try and realize that inherent value with what are clearly, overly discounted assets, but they have to kind of be a bit more creative in trying to realize that. And it might be merging with a smaller producer or, two companies coming together can really unlock and release some of that inherent value. Because if a company doesn't have a funding route, it ultimately trades to a discount, which we've seen, and we've encouraged them to look to, and we're seeing this more activity. We've seen larger companies coming in at 9.9% stakes, or merge with a peer, or do something more creative to try and create that value, because you can't just sit on your laurels and expect that the market's going to come good, because we've gone through a long period of this. But equally, that value is there. Realize it and try and do it through something smarter and that you can actually control yourself, rather than waiting for the market to turn. And that's certainly a message that we continually feed back to any of our junior names in trying to realize that. And often we can be 9.9% type holders in these junior names, if not larger, and we're very much instrumental in trying to push those through. So there is a value creation over and above for everyone involved.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really talked about sentiment in specific terms during this conversation. Do you think sentiment's going to be better in 2025 than it has been in the last 2 or 3 years?
Well, I think, I mean, you've then got to look at your subsectors. So I think for resource managers are generally pretty positive. So sentiment's quite good for specialists into the sector, but they're kind of generally invested, as are we across our general fund. I think retail, generally sentiment's pretty poor. Most people have kind of moved on or been carried out by a struggling sector overall. And then really it's kind of looking to the generalist, more institutional kind of generalist money, and whether that comes back in, which we touched on earlier. But yeah, I think sentiment is still relatively weak overall. And I think there's definitely scope for a re-rate.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the guys that coming back from Indaba say about the vibe down there, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right, guys, thanks very much for your time. We'll wrap it up there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.